Barlow presents The Birch Brothers, a final western of the last frontier, written and read by Mark Whitman.
Drop by drop, a whiskey barrel grows brimful, and sure as dew flows from the mountain, a tin cup gets in the way for tasting. Ladies and gentlemen, the work of empire is a brew. This is not highbrow history, but the underbelly of bygone times. A truth that is ours alone, and it rides the tide like a chunk of glacier ice, most of it beneath the surface. A tale of whiskey, hooch, and those that traded it. Speak of Richard Harris and Joe Juno and a golden voyage of discovery, but the first arrival always involves a keg of hard spirits. Real whiskey or some vile counterfeit dyed and doctored to seem real and burn like hell. Our pioneer prospectors have it with them in the dugout canoe, right there. And as long as they keep their wits about them, a traded taste of spirit seems to open the way. It was ever so. The French, the Russians, early Boston men, all came with a ceremonial toast of hard liquor to trade for furs in a rain-filled land, seeking the bargain of spirited trade. In Lituya Bay, La Perouse offered a Tlingit chief a ceremonial toast. That first swallow brought a gut-level response. The chief said, "This stuff could be the ruin of us." Devilish and fly, something first reviled was later sought by many. Our journey to the Golden West was never guided by the Star of Empire. Mark Twain said it best. The van leader of civilization is always whiskey. Look history over, you will see. The missionary comes after the whiskey. Next comes the poor immigrant with axe and hoe and rifle. And then the trader, the miscellaneous rush, the gambler, the desperado, the highwaymen, and all their kindred in sin of both sexes. And then that smart chap who has bought up an old land grant that covers all the land. This brings the lawyer tribe, the vigilance committee, brings the undertaker. The newspaper starts up politics and a railroad, and all hands turn to and build a church and a jail. And behold, civilization is established forever in the land. But whiskey was the van leader in this beneficent work. Always is. Westward, the jug of empire takes its way. Simon, pure American history, untaught in my school, but it stands as blunt gospel. Alaska was no exception to this truth. Distant Washington tried to outlaw liquor from the start, but spirits found a way, a smuggler's route through island coves, bays, and channels of the inside passage. Once the drink of monks and kings, whiskey found a home on the rocky shores of Douglas Island. The genuine article, and a nasty home-brewed hooch that could take the hair off a dog. So comes the whiskey trader, bringing those nearby to join the game. Just offshore, the sound of a tin cup tapping the hull of a canoe or sloop. It's a cheap sound, a hollow clank on wood announcing the keg's arrival. The tin cup, used for samples, banging out the beat of that same old song.
Rye whiskey, rye whiskey, I cry. Well, I must have rye whiskey, or I surely will die. Beefsteak when I'm hungry, and whiskey when I'm dry, and greenbacks when I'm hard up, and heaven when I die. Rye whiskey, rye whiskey, well, whiskey I cry. I must have rye whiskey, or I surely will die.
Pioneer Dr. Harry DeVigne called Douglas City the wettest town in Alaska, and he didn't mean rain. His first job was sewing up scalps of men who fought nightly with broken bottles on the saloon-filled waterfront of First and Front Street. By 1914, this four-block section of Douglas Shoreline boasted 15 saloons and 27 domiciles graciously labeled FB on the Sanborn Fire Insurance maps, female boarding houses. Here, miners' pockets were emptied nightly by the Waterfront Alliance. The rule of no drinking at Treadwell Mine allowed Douglas to make a fortune in liquid assets. Edwardsville, Newtown, and Cooperston all competed for town title, but Douglas City won out. Its first citizens, clustered in tents, were not hard rock miners who rose to a steam whistle, taking a long ride down into darkness. No, the town's first drifters were a rough lot. The director of San Francisco's mint called them an unlawful body of men. With the mine's wealthy backers, the director wanted to send a militia of 200 men north to drive these squatters off the claim site, but John Treadwell compromised. He used the water of Paris Creek at night and waited till all the free courts were sluiced off by the placer men who worked by day. The only authority they respected was their own. 1885, the free courts gone, Treadwell built his mine. A sawmill rose on the beach, and stonemasons, Chinese miners, and carpenters raised a 120-stamp mill and bunkhouses as quick as logs were cut and mortar dried. And the people rushed in, natives, whites, miners, and whiskey men. Tents were pitched. Shacks were built overnight and opportunities seized in the golden enterprise. The giant stamp mills began to pound and shake the hills with the sound of money being made day and night. Just north of the sawmill, a small town formed, scraped from the skunk cabbage, bog, and forest. No military garrison on a hilltop, no miners' meetings to set rules, no marshal, jail, or church. But no shortage of whiskey, loose women, and dance halls. Yep, Douglas City was primed for trouble, and it happened in one spot on that crooked dogleg road of the whiskey waterfront. First, it was the Chinese. Treadwell's ticket to a healthy profit was built on using cheap Chinese labor, but when they were run out at gunpoint in August of 1886, his plan went south on two schooners with all of them. Why were the Chinese run out? Well, history tells us it was the Irish and other immigrants who wanted their jobs. Not quite, at least not in Douglas and Juneau. Among the 87 Chinese crammed onto two schooners was one Fong Sing, former student of Mrs. Bradway's school in Oakland, California, fluent in English. He explained that the Treadwell Chinese saved every ounce of gold for their families back in China. They did their own ordering of rice, dried goods, and opium half a year ahead, and they did not spend 1 cent in the saloon as the white miners did. Fong Sing told names of the leaders that led the expulsion: Jack Timmons, Pat McClinchy, Frank Berry, and Sam Wheelock, all saloon men in Douglas and Juneau. That unlawful body of men. 2 months later, October 17, 1886, Tlingit natives hired by Treadwell to replace the low-wage Chinese had just received their first pay for work in the mine. And despite the laws against it, they were busy buying hard spirits at Jim Thompson's music hall on the waterfront. It was hard to miss this clapboard dive on the beach. Large letters were painted on the channel side that said Music Hall. Well, the only tune played that night, just after midnight, was Whiskey Riot. Walter Pierce, the barkeep, refused to serve more liquor to the customers, and the ruckus began. Windows were broken, chairs and lights smashed, and then two shots rang out. Two men fell. Clue Keats, of the Cake tribe, shot dead through the heart, and Captain Merriwalt alive with a bullet through his chest. Neither were in the saloon, but simply passing by. Dawn came, and Douglas City looked like a hostile army had passed through. Shattered glass and splintered wood everywhere. 7 saloon owners, including one female, were put in irons and taken off to jail in Sitka. Bartender Walter Pierce would stand trial for murder. Judge Lafayette Dawson spoke at final sentencing words that made Douglas residents shudder. He told Deputy Whitenhiller, if any building sells liquor to natives, set a fiery torch to it without hesitation. Judge Dawson would back the deputy on the principles of necessity and self-defense. You say fire and Douglas and people listen. Let the historical record speak. This is the spot where the whiskey riot broke out in 1886. And this is the place between saloons where a grease fire at the Owl Restaurant in 1911 nearly torched the town. If the Taku wind had not shifted, the whole town would have been ashes. And this is the same spot in Fusey's Hardware Store, between saloons, where the fire of 23 February 1937 started. And that fire did take the whole town. Ladies and gentlemen, this is the same spot where the Birch Brothers set up their saloon in 1896, just to the left where the broken-down Washateria sits today, that crooked dogleg in the road. Like bad weather, things came to a head for the Birch Brothers on 20 October 1896, a Tuesday night in Douglas where darkness came early. It must have been a foul wind blowing down the channel, stirring the waves along that bend in the road and setting people's teeth on edge. The Douglas City Hotel and Saloon had been built by Michael Bernard McKenna back in 1887. He and his family had learned the rule of making quick liquor money off a nearby military fort back in Miles City, Montana, and now set up a similar operation in Douglas with miners instead of soldiers. Letters appeared in Montana's Yellowstone Journal with increasing regularity, luring 12 to 13 former citizens of Miles City to move and set up shop in Douglas with their families. Robert Birch and his wife of less than 2 years, Sarah, took over management of the saloon in early 1896. Now, Bob alone would have been enough, but bring the other brothers in, Joseph, known as Kid, and William Thomas, shortened to Slim, bring those two in, and now you've raised the ante for sure. Brothers try to outdo each other like hounds in a pack. Mix that with mean disposition and whiskey, and you've got a full house of trouble. It was a fight between barkeeps. Slim Birch of the Brothers establishment and Harry Osborne, the mixologist of the Standard Music Hall right next door. Cheek to jowl and liquor competition, the two men quarreled at the start of the week over a dime tab for a beer. A small thing, but remember, this was October in Douglas. Slim Birch went straight for the gun he kept behind the bar, dead serious he was, but brothers Kid and Bob took it from him. Punching and brawling, the fight fell into the street and then over to Osborne's music hall. Osborne, on his own ground now, went for his gun, but again Bob and Kid stepped in and pulled the firearm away and pushed the outsiders back from the fight. The brothers stood behind Slim, now on top of his opponent, and started to urge him on with Brother Bob, shouting, "Bite his nose off!" You lose your inhibitions with drink. Happened for Slim, who tore the tip of Osborne's nose off with his teeth and then a chunk of one ear, just for emphasis. Yeah, the Birch Brothers were in trouble again with Slim in the lead. Born of rough Irish-Canadian stock who moved down from Ontario, Canada, to North Dakota, these boys had a shadow side dark for even Douglas City. Illegal sale of whiskey was the least of it. All three had a hard time with authority figures. Deputy Collector W.C. Pedler was quickly uninvited from ever crossing the threshold of their saloon early on. Then Deputy William C. Watts, making the rounds one day, had been ordered to leave the Birch Saloon. When he failed to comply, Deputy Watts was assaulted by the brothers. Jailed and brought before Judge Mellon, both Kid and Slim were found guilty of assault and charged $50, which is $1,385 in today's money. Slim was starting to spend more time in a cell on Juneau's Courthouse Hill than serving drinks at the bar. William Thomas Slim Birch, in particular, had a genuine loathing for the assistant superintendent of the Treadwell Mine, John P. Corbus. On the 3rd of July, Slim approached Corbus and his wife, crossing the Treadwell Plaza in a rude manner, grossly insulting them both. Arrested and charged with indecent conduct, Slim went to the calaboose in Juneau again, fined $50 more. Meanwhile, local businessmen started receiving letters from authorities down south warning them to look out for the Birch brothers. After 8 months in Douglas, things were not looking up for the Birch Quorum, Slim in particular. After the saloon brawl, a warrant was sworn out by the wounded Osborne, with Kid and Bob immediately arrested. Slim was hiding, but Deputy Watts was able to round him up in no time, and Watts put him in irons and walked him down D Street, then onto the long wooden dock out to where a small steam ferry was tied up at deep water, the boiler hissing in wait for the journey over the channel. That long, wallowing ride, a good half hour with no wind, gave both men plenty of time to sit and stare at each other, one holding loaded iron and the other shackled by it. Plenty of time for Slim Birch to think over the reasons he hated deputies. More reasons and more deputies than Watts would ever know. Charged with mayhem, the Birch boys were jailed by Judge Mellon, and bail was set at $6,000 each. That's $166,000 in today's money. Now there's a message. Bonds presented by attorneys were refused for lack of full compliance with statutes, and a writ of habeas corpus sworn out before Judge Jackson got no ground at all. Robert and Kid were taken to jail, and Sitka and Slim stayed in the Juneau stockade where Deputy Watts had put him. Running a saloon in Douglas was no longer an option for the Birch boys. When they went to trial at the district court, Kid was acquitted. Robert was charged with assault and sentenced to 10 months in the Sitka jail. It took a second trial, but Slim was finally convicted for the crime of mayhem. Judge Delaney fined him $500, that's $13,888 in today's money, and sentenced him to 3 years of making burlap bags at San Quentin Penitentiary. The 9th of January, 1897, was another quiet, dreary night at the jail, with only two prisoners up on the hill, Slim Birch and one native resident. Head Marshal Lewis Williams would soon arrive from Sitka on the steamer Al Key to transport the eldest Birch brother south to San Quentin. Marshal Williams was known to be quite casual when transporting convicts. Guards at San Quentin were amazed to learn that he didn't carry a firearm with him on his transports to the southern penitentiary. About 11 o'clock, the night guard Gus Lindquist heard the front door of the courthouse open and footsteps in the unlit hallway. Must be Marshal Hale bringing in a Saturday night drunk, Gus thought. Swinging the door of the guard room wide, he felt two loaded pistols shoved in his face by a man with a hooded face. "Throw up your hands," was the order. Gus complied. Then two other men entered the hallway, faces concealed by red flannel masks. The armed leader ordered the others to search the watchman and take his revolver. Keys to the jail cells hung in their usual spot, well known by the lead intruder. He seized them and motioned the guard down toward the jail. Once in the prison area, Lindquist tried to buy time by going to the wrong cell door, but the masked leader, pistols in hand, was having none of that. He knew his way around the jail for sure. He motioned to the cell where Slim was kept. When the door was unlocked, William Thomas came out pulling his coat on, and Lindquist was thrust inside. The door slammed and locked. Quick as they came, the masked men slipped out the courthouse entrance with their comrade into a black moonless night. Gus Lindquist hollered himself hoarse, finally rousing the other men upstairs, Assistant U.S. Attorney Daly and the day guard Andrew Bays. After they unlocked the rear door of the jail, they soon learned of Slim's escape. One of them stepped to the front of the courthouse and fired three shots into the night sky, the signal for trouble up at the jail. The trail from the courthouse down to the beachfront was littered with discarded masks, white and red with holes cut out for sight, and an iron bar and sledgehammer cast aside. These were robbed from the mouth of the Bonanza Goldstein Tunnel, its door forced and broken. They were the backup plan if no keys were acquired. It had been at least four men, one to enter the hall quietly and put the lights out, two others to enter with noise attracting attention, and one to keep watch outside. They knew where and when to move. The steamer Rustler was soon searching up and down the channel, but the black night and foul weather hid every clue. Talk of Slim's escape, rumored during his incarceration, turned out to be more than jailhouse bluff. After breathing stale air for 3 months in a cramped cell, Slim was out on the run and maybe gone for good. Deputy Marshal Hale, in charge of Juneau, while Head Marshal Williams was in Sitka, immediately posted a $100 reward for the capture of Slim Birch. Williams arrived Monday and raised the reward to $250 for information leading to the escapee's capture. Finally, local contributions raised it to $500. That's $13,888 in today's money. From Dyea to Tacoma, folks were on the lookout for a man 35 to 40, about 6'1" and 185 pounds. Shoulders wide and quite square, but turned sideways, the depth of his chest was far less than the average man. He was raw-boned, muscular, and walked lame on the right side, moving with a slouch, long-armed and shuffling, and the little finger of his right hand was gone. Dark brown hair, heavy brown mustache, and dark brown eyes, and a recent scar straight across the bridge of his nose. Despite big money and many searches, there was no trace of Slim Birch. The path William C. Watts took to becoming the deputy marshal of Douglas was neither quick nor easy. Not as popular as Deputy Hale, Watts worked his way up from his first post as jailer at the Juneau Courthouse. But when it came to chasing down strays, Watts had the skill of a human bloodhound. He was born in Delaware to a family of considerable wealth and social standing, but abandoned home at the age of 14. About 1873, he set out alone for New Mexico. Watts' ambition, his dream, was to be a cowboy. And the next 15 years of his life were spent raising cattle and driving them to market over the plains of the West. In his time, he had seen more than one rounder robbed of his season's earnings in the saloons of Topeka, Denver, and later in Montana, where one of his brothers resided in the cattle business. But whiskey and wild ways were not a part of Watts' vocabulary. He was a devoted member of the Knights of Pythias, and he seemed to take the oath seriously. "I declare upon honor that I believe in a supreme being, that I am not a professional gambler, or unlawfully engaged in the wholesale or retail sale of intoxicating liquors or narcotics, and that I believe in the maintenance of the order and the upholding of constituted authority in the government in which I live. Moreover, I declare upon honor that I am not a communist or a fascist." Being a deputy and a Knight of Pythias was not enough. Watts signed on as a deputy collector of customs with collector Benjamin P. Moore in 1895. In April of that year, Watts did a forced 16-mile march from Dyea to Sheep Camp in record time. Not pausing to rest, in the face of a blinding snowstorm, he climbed to the summit of the Chilkoot Pass and spent hours rooting deep into the drifts till he found 200 gallons of liquor kegs hidden in the snow. Unable to transport it back, Watts did not hesitate. He took an axe to all of it. The sight of 200 gallons of whiskey bleeding dark into the snow was unthinkable. Watts made a name for himself, and he made enemies. Genuine Kentucky bourbon, amber red, bleeding into the white snow. Well, it was enough to make a grown man fall to his knees and cry, and then start scooping snowballs. On another occasion, the chlorination vats in Treadwell were robbed of $10,000 worth of gold by a gang of thieves led by a hard case named Hiram Shell. Shell and his partners were finally captured by two Pinkerton detectives disguised, of all things, as whiskey traders in a canoe. They found the thieves and the stolen gold over by Killisnoo. Major blame for the crime fell on the head of Frank Jurgens, the former mine foreman at Treadwell, well-respected in Douglas till he fell in with Shell. Hiram Shell was given a sentence of 1 year. No longer watched by Watts, he was moved to the jail in Sitka. Jurgens got 3 years in San Quentin, the maximum sentence then available. Just before Jurgens was taken south, he made a running leap through one of the glass windows of the Juneau courthouse, landing on the ground outside. Well, Watts, again, did not hesitate. Before glass stopped falling, he sailed out through the same window and had Jurgens pinned to the ground like a steer for branding. Watts knew what it meant to go after strays in the herd and in a hurry. In Douglas, he was known for raiding houses along the waterfront where saloon men hid their liquor among the shacks of the native people, using homes and lives along the beachfront to hide their bottled goods. Watts found barrels of hooch hidden up the creeks of South Douglas Island and in the snowbanks on the Sheep Creek side. He had a nose for it, he did. He was not a liked man. He knew the job, and he did it with conviction. 2 weeks after Slim Birch vanished down the Midnight Channel, folks in Douglas City saw Deputy Watts with Native policeman Sam Johnson heading down D Street to the dock and boarding the small tug Lucy, owned by the Treadwell Mine. They pushed off for Juneau at full steam. At the courthouse, Deputy Hale and the two jail guards, Andrew Bays and Gus Lindquist, loaded for action. 5 men, moving down Main Street to the wharf, Winchester rifles and shotguns in hand, left no doubt in anyone's mind that something was up. Boarding Lucy and steaming off down Gastineau Channel, word now spread. The Tlingit community had spoken. Slim Birch and his party were hiding on Admiralty Island. Captain Steve York and Engineer Anderson guided the Lucy down to the southern end of Douglas Island. Rounding Marmion Island, they lay to till early morning, and then they set out up Frederick Sound to a small stream on Admiralty Island, Bear Creek, straight across from the north end of Douglas Island. Deputy Hale took his party of 4 men ashore, leaving the Lucy at anchor with Captain York and the engineer. The party made their way to a small cabin on the beach where 4 miners resided, all Douglas men. They insisted they had seen no one over the last month. There was no information coming from this group, and none of them wanted any involvement at all. Hale did learn of a small cabin about 2 miles up Bear Creek, something to go on. They took a path parallel to the stream, following footprints that led uphill through soft snow into the forest. About 2 miles in was a small cabin in a tight clearing, blue smoke rising from the chimney. Well, here I wish I could tell you, our party of men proceeded with a plan of caution. Their plan was a simple one, naive at best, knock on the cabin door. The men inside the cabin, they had a plan too. One Slim Birch had thought over in prison long and hard. A plan for revenge carried out with deadly precision. Above the cabin door between 2 logs, Slim and his accomplice had removed the chinking between 2 logs, creating a porthole 7 feet wide for rifles and pistols. From the back of the cabin, a path had been carved uphill in a curve to protected high ground for a covered vantage point from which to shoot and kill. 1 tap from the butt of Deputy Watts' Winchester on the side of the cabin and all hell broke loose. From inside, a volley of shots tore through the wood door, with one bullet going straight through Andrew Bay's leg, dropping him to the ground, bleeding heavily. Deputy Hale and Watts returned fire, but being in the open, they retreated to the cover of low tree stumps, exactly where Slim wanted them. Hale shouted to Sam Johnson, the native policeman, to assist Bays. It was Sam Johnson who saved Bays' life, dragging him out of the line of fire. Hale ordered them to head for the beach, get Bays taken care of, and bring help. Then someone shouted from the shattered cabin door, "You try to take Slim Birch, will you?" Watts and Hale realized they were being circled. Someone on the rise above them stood up behind a snowdrift and fired down on them. Deputy Hale took a running dive behind a large log in the creek bed. They were both pinned down now. Hale found Watts in the creek gully with his leg badly shattered by a bullet, either a 38-90 or a 45-70, both with enough wallop to take strange paths through the body. He tried to move Watts to a better position when he felt a bullet rip through the back of his left hip and down into his groin. Both men were mortally wounded. Hale tried to crawl further down, but his strength was going fast. Imagine how he felt when he looked up and saw Sam Johnson, back from the beach, ducking low from the shots raining down. Gus Lindquist, who had escaped injury, helped Sam Johnson drag Hale further down the creek bed. They were able to support and move him down the creek and onto the trail a half mile below, then headed down for the beach. Reaching the shore, they pleaded with the men in the beach cabin to help rescue Watts. The men would have none of it, not even lending a rifle to Captain York, who wanted to go to the aid of Watts. No, the Lucy left for Juneau carrying 6 men instead of 7. And up on Bear Creek, William C. Watts faced his enemies alone. Slim Birch was a deadly shot. Aiming down at Watts in the creek bed, his first bullet had entered the back of Watts' left thigh, spiraled down, severing his femoral artery, and blowing out his kneecap. That would have killed him, but Birch was methodical. Slim's second shot, delivered when all had left, slammed through the same wounded hip and rode up into the middle of Watts' belly, turning the snow around him red. His life was over. Very few come back from death's door and tell us what they've seen. Some speak of a circle of light, a bright tunnel. It could be a spinning gyre of angels, or maybe the muzzle flash from a gun's round barrel. I don't know. What I do know is that no one should doubt the end of their own life. We all carry a circle inside us, the alpha and the omega of our first and last breath. And when those two are joined, they form a hoop, and that is the perimeter of our life, scribed and set. In the final constriction of the eyes, the tightening of the pupils, there where light enters the mind, we might find a portal to something larger. I can only imagine. But this is where William C. Watts was, dying in the cold of January, high in the frozen hills, with the winter wind around him, blood flowing from his bullet-shattered body staining the snow, taking life's last warmth from him, eyes staring at the pale light. This is the heart of this story, and to this place, to this moment, I return again and again in my mind. To die alone, voices of friends and enemies all leaving, no company but the circle of sky above. To die alone, voices of friends and enemies all leaving, no company but the circle of sky above. To die alone in the great land, alone in duty, living it out, frozen sight watching till the end. I am compelled and driven to share this story with all of you, so that the memory of this man's death will not disappear. Ooh.
You're listening to The Birch Brothers, a final western of the last frontier, written and read by Mark Whitman.
Douglas and Juno folk had seen the Lucy returning full steam down the channel. Heard her whistle blow 3x3, a signal to bring a doctor at once. By the time they tied off at the city wharf, Dr. Simpson stepping on board, a crowd of more than 100 stood on the wharf watching. The news of what happened spread like a Taku wind. People watched in silence as the wounded lawmen were carried to St. Anne's Hospital, and the story of what Slim Birch and his accomplices had done was soon told. The steamer Lucy was sent off to Sitka to alert Governor Shakely and Marshal Williams at once. Birch was moving ever closer to the outside waters of the open sea, and the only hope of stopping him was to act without hesitation. The right man to act and lead was needed, and needed now. That was Jacob T. Martin, captain of the steamboat Rustler, veteran of the Union Army in the Civil War, respected by citizens of both Douglas and Juno. Martin was sworn in with a posse of 19 capable men, armed and ready. They pushed off from the city dock by 8 p.m., and the community was with them. The dock swarmed with citizens who cheered 3x as the Rustler pulled away. Captain Martin would not tolerate nonsense. He was swift and decisive and did not hesitate to act. His party landed by Bear Creek near midnight and made straight for the miner's cabin on the shoreline. Without a word, the cabin door was kicked open and Martin ordered the men inside at gunpoint to get up, pull their boots on, and lead the search party to Slim's hideout. There was no argument. Silently, through snow 2 to 3 feet deep, the column of men made their way. By 4 in the morning, they reached the cabin. The murderers had abandoned it. A month of firewood, provisions, 5 sides of bacon hanging from the rafters. Martin's posse found a full 50-pound box of dynamite tucked beneath one of the bunks, and the floor was littered with spent bullet casings, 38-90s and 45-70s. Martin ordered the supplies burned in case Slim should circle back. Footprints revealed 2 men, one of them Birch, setting off to cross the island. The posse's plan was to leave half the party to cross over the Ridge of Admiralty, while the other half would run the Rustler up around Point Retreat, coming down the coast to intercept the fugitives. But they would need more coal, more provisions, and more men. As much time as it would take, they could not avoid going back to Juneau. Captain Martin and his men turned to the grim business of collecting the body of Deputy Watts. He was not more than 500 feet from the cabin, his rifle pointing toward the sky, clenched in frozen hands, his lips parted and teeth set tight. His eyes wide open were filmed with ice, and his leg lay shattered and twisted out of shape beside him in that red circle of snow. There was nothing easy about this death. In silence, the men wrapped his body in a blanket, lifting it onto a makeshift stretcher for the journey down to the shoreline. Monday afternoon, in the falling light, eyes kept turning down the channel for some sign of the Rustler's return. Finally, a steamer was seen turning past Marmion Island, moving toward town. Hundreds gathered on the dock as the Rustler steamed in. No words needed. The sight of the stretcher lashed to the bow with a body wrapped in a blanket said enough. The posse quietly lifted Watts, carried him up the gangplank, through the crowd parting before them, making a path for the dead and those who bore him. In silence, they walked to C.W. Young's building, to the undertaker's room where the coroner's inquest was held. The sad events of the past days were written in the diary of Peter Trimble Rowe. Quote, "A large party went last night by Rustler to find Watts, who, being wounded, was left on Admiralty Island, returned today with his body, which had been riddled by bullets of the Birch Gang." Unquote. The first peace officer to die in the line of duty in Alaska, William C. Watts. Today he is unknown and forgotten, But on a cold Wednesday morning in January, Douglas and Juno turned out in force to honor his memory. The funeral service was held in the newly built Trinity Episcopal Church, less than a year old, led by the new bishop, Peter Trimble Rowe. He served as Bishop of Alaska from 1895 until 1942. Rowe knew what it meant to sleep on the ground at 60 below, to mush 2,000 miles in a year, and how to pick off wolves outside his camp circle with a rifle. He bunked with both Tex Rickard and Jack London, and shared with London what he knew about huskies. He gave his first sermon in a Fairbanks saloon wearing beaded moccasins under his church vestments, and never ceased in his efforts to build hospitals and aid those in need. He gave his all to Alaska, and on this day he reminded the community to take hope in the resurrection and the light. Watt's body was laid out and stayed at the church altar. Bishop Rowe noted in his diary that the church was so full, the doors were left open for all to hear despite the cold. The Knights of Pythias were there, the local firemen, and the Juneau City Band, all in uniform. The body was loaded onto a horse-drawn hearse, and the procession was led by the Juneau City Band. They played the same march used at the funerals of Washington and Lincoln, Handel's Dead March in Saul. Slowly, making their way along 3rd Street and down the long road to Evergreen Cemetery, the community had plenty of time to reflect on their loss. William C. Watts was buried in Evergreen Cemetery on Wednesday, the 27th of January. There is no mention of his burial in the cemetery records, only newspapers. To the best of my knowledge, despite repeated searches in that silent green field, there is no indication of his burial spot. Nothing. Back on Admiralty Island, up on that snow-covered backbone of mountains and the sea, the weather that only Alaska knows was whipping up. Those high wisps like smoke that first appear on the mountaintops. The Taku winds had arrived, and there would be nothing easy about hunting down Slim Birch. You pin a silver star on your chest, then you give bad men something to draw down on. Hold it in the palm of your hand and tell me what it weighs. You need to think long and hard about pinning this on. It will draw ill will and evil intention down on your head and heart. One cowboy falls, and another takes his place, chasing down strays. Here in the midst of the manhunt for Slim Birch, there was no hesitation by another Montana cowboy to step in and wear the silver star. June Bazell, also known as Montana Bill, held the shortest term as deputy marshal in the history of Douglas City, 15 days. But Junius more than earned his wages for the task set before him. To capture Birch, the posse, now 40 men, was split in two parties. One would follow the path up Bear Creek to where the shooting took place, then follow Birch's trail up over the snow-covered peaks of Admiralty. The other party would remain on the Rustler and steam around Point Retreat, down the coast, past Funter Bay to Green Bay, hopefully stopping the outlaws from crossing Chatham Strait. The way across the island was a rough path to follow. First leading along the ridge and then plunging down into the canyon along the creek bed, then tracing a zigzag path of switchbacks back up the steep mountainside all through deep drifts. Bazell was the cowpuncher for the job. He had lived through the winter of 1886 when just about every cow in Montana froze to death. He was no stranger to cold. Cold it was, with one main difference. No horse to ride this ridge with. It was one mean slog. Those who live here don't even want to imagine this hike. When the Takus blow, you put one booted foot through creek ice, pull it out, and before you get your gloves off, you can watch your bootlaces freeze solid. That quick, in about 3 eye blinks. Lazelle's party started at noon, and by dusk they could look down from the high slopes to Admiralty's far shore where the Rustler rode at anchor. At tide line, they signaled the steamer and a skiff shuttled over to bring them on board. Imagine how those men felt by the rustler's coal-fired boiler. Carry a firearm in that weather, gloves or no gloves, a heavy piece of metal pulls heat right out of your hands, stiffens fingers, something fierce. That's just bone cold with a screaming wind on top. There were new faces among the men on board, a Clinkett family who lived in a solitary cabin on that shore. They had been brought on board. The native man of that lonely place had a story to tell. As his words were translated, all listened. Two men, hungry and cold, came down from the mountains. The Clinkett man described one of them. He was the nervous one, tall and dark-eyed, dark mustache. After entering the cabin, he kept pacing to the door time and again, peering out to see if anyone was approaching. His rifle never left his hands the whole time they were there. The two men tried to hire the Clinkett gentleman to take them across Chatham Strait in his canoe. He refused. It was too rough. Only a fool or a dead man would try to cross Chatham Strait in a Taku wind. They offered him a watch and their rifle in payment, and again he refused. His suspicions aroused, the native let the desperate man have 4 biscuits of pilot bread, and they disappeared up into the timber, but not before seizing some of the family's venison. At dawn, the deputies moved in on the lone beach cabin. It was empty with no trace of the outlaws. Now, dividing into several parties, the posse spread out along the hillside, looking for any tracks up into the woods. At this point, among the men, a Clinkett named Frederick Moore emerged. As a youth, he was chosen by Sheldon Jackson for education at the Carlisle School in Pennsylvania. Fluent in English and Clinkett, he used both as an accomplished preacher of the Presbyterian Church. He worked among the natives of both Douglas and Juneau, and that morning, with 2 other men, he was out hunting. They brought hunting dogs with them. What a concept when going out after game or outlaws. Hunting dogs. Stepping in to help out the posse, they soon took the lead. The dogs immediately picked up a trail into the forest. Looking down into a hollow, they saw 2 men huddled beneath 1 blanket on a bed of tree boughs. They appeared to be in an exhausted slumber. Keeping a rifle and a silent watch over them, one of the natives went back for more men. He encountered R.S. Cheney and L.H. Olson and motioned to them, signaling they had found Slim Birch. They rushed to the lookout, and seeing them huddled below, L.H. Olson jumped down on the sleeping men, shouting, "Surrender!" Well, finally, the face of Slim Birch's accomplice came into view. It was Hiram Shell, the man who had robbed gold from the Treadwell mine 2 years back, recently out of jail. Strange that he should be seeking a way back in so soon. Both men spoke. "Don't shoot!" Olson grabbed Slim's left hand, still clutching his large Colt revolver, and said, "We've got you covered. You better give up." And Slim looked up at Olson and said, "Hello, Pete. I know when I'm covered." Birch surrendered his weapon, and Olson used his own belt to bind up Slim's wrists. Neither Hiram Shell nor Birch offered an ounce of resistance as they marched down to the beach. The long, cold hunt was over. From Sunday till Wednesday, the experience of the outlaws was a bitter one. At the end of their strength, capture was likely welcome. That close to a full escape and then stopped by Alaska's winter, Slim Birch learned firsthand Southeast Alaska can be one hard place to get out of. Trying to steam out of Funter Bay, then around Point Retreat, that was true indeed. The wind was blowing a perfect hurricane, almost ripping the pilot house off the Rustler, and the steamer had to retreat to shelter to wait out the wind. The prisoners were transferred to a succession of boats when the USS Pinta finally appeared 3 days late. Now, this was the same ship that failed to arrive in time to stop the expulsion of the Chinese in 1886 due to mechanical difficulty. Now, 11 years later, the boiler had blown, shooting bolts into 3 crew members, putting them in the Sitka Hospital. When the old iron-hulled vessel finally arrived, Shell and Birch were locked in irons and taken to the old prison in Sitka. At least that jail had iron bars. There was no need for the two captives to speak, but both men seemed dead set on sharing their version of what happened. Slim Birch took all the blame and told a story that even a 5-year-old would have doubted. Slim said he'd kidnapped Shell near the jail, took him 14 miles to the cabin on Admiralty, and held him captive for over 2 weeks. Having a loaded gun of his own, Shell claimed he never fired a shot. He said Birch forced him to hike over the ridge of Admiralty, and then he stated he was forced to lie down under one blanket with his loaded revolver in hand and a rifle between them, never trying to escape. It was all Slim's fault. Getting enough legs under this story so it could stand up in court before a judge and jury would require a master storyteller, a true silver-tongued devil, in other words, a lawyer. So Kid Birch, the only brother out of jail, set off to Circle City and Dawson. A popular man in the mining camps, Joseph Kid Birch set out to raise cash for the best mouthpiece gold could buy. 10 months. The two men sat in that old Sitka jail. 10 long months, and in that time, the whole world rushed in. The Birch brothers, once able to reach a fortune and liquid assets, now gazed out on lost opportunity through prison bars as the Klondike Gold Rush exploded. How large was this lost opportunity? Well, instead of just saying hooch or liquid assets, let's talk about spirits and dollars and cents, what was so tempting about this nefarious trade. Let me quote from Stephen C. Levi's wonderful book, Boom and Bust in the Alaska Goldfield. The price of whiskey varied, and the further up the Yukon River one went, the more valuable whiskey became. A shot of scotch went for $1.25, which in today's money is $34.72. And as late as 1900, in Nome at Jordan's Saloon, he had a homemade brew that sold for 75 cents a shot. In today's money, that's $20.83. But the ingredients to make a gallon of this only cost 60 cents, which is a little more than $16. That means a clear profit of $95.40 a gallon. In today's money, that's $2,638 for a gallon of homemade hooch. Talk about serious money. 10 long months for the hard edge of Watt's murder to wear off, and almost every witness rushed off to seek fortune further north. New arrivals swamped Juneau and Douglas daily, and the memory of Admiralty Island and the January manhunt was swept aside. 10 long months for a new president, William McKinley, to win election, appoint a new governor, judge, and marshal for the District of Alaska. All strangers to the case of Slim Birch and Hiram Shell. Alaska's new U.S. Marshal, James M. Shoup, was far more cautious than his predecessor, Lewis Williams. Shoup, a veteran of the final Indian wars of Montana and Idaho, had recently dealt with the violent labor war that destroyed the Bunker Hill and Sullivan mines in Wallace, Idaho. A bloody struggle between mine owners and union men of the Western Federation of Miners, that conflict would make anyone careful. When Shoup took over the Juneau Courthouse, he knew Birch and Shell's trial would be in November. Planning ahead, he sent a letter to the U.S. Attorney General in Washington, D.C., requesting a battleship to watch over the harbor during the trial. He believed the Birch brothers would try and escape again. There would be no battleship in Juneau during the trial. Instead, 22 United States Marines and their captain were sent from the barracks in Sitka. Armed and ready, the detachment stood guard around the courthouse for the entire Juneau trial. An unwelcome homecoming greeted both criminals entering the same cramped cells beneath the courthouse. Cramped and cold, as the trial started, Taku wind swept down from the peaks, nailing the town along with hail the size of marbles. That tall wooden courthouse on the hill shuddered with every gust. Joseph Kidd Birch boasted of raising over $10,000, that's $277,000 in today's money, for his brother and Hiram's defense, donated by the miners of Circle City and Dawson. Well, maybe so. But what was certain was the power and experience of the defense team. The prosecution, Alaska District Attorney Bennett and Assistant Daly, were no match for the talented barrister John C. Leisure of Oregon, along with his attorneys Letty and Cruz. Birch and Shell faced three charges: murder, assault with a deadly weapon with intent, and resisting arrest. The defense was simple. "Of course, Slim," had shot the deputies, but only in self-defense. Leisure asserted that the deputies had not properly identified themselves. When Deputy Marshal Hale was called to the stand, still carrying a slug from Slim's Winchester in his body, his whole testimony was challenged by Colonel Letty. Letty had the journey chuckling when he said the deputies were so scared during the gunplay that they could not tell you if Christ was killed on Calvary or Bunker Hill. The defense further stated Hiram Shell had never fired a shot. Who knows what kind of sway the Birch brothers had over the men of the jury. They deliberated for 18 hours, finally decided that Slim Birch had the best lawyers. Both men were acquitted of all charges. As for Slim, despite the victory of the defense team, Slim Birch still had a sentence of 3 years to serve at San Quentin, that charge of mayhem for using his teeth on Harry Osborne's nose and ear, that still stood. 3 years for a fight and not a day for murder. You have to look long and hard to find justice in that. 3 months later, Slim gone to San Quentin. On the night of January 25, 1898, strong winds slammed Juneau, keeping residents in their homes. Exactly 1 year before, on the same date, William C. Watts died a lonely death on Admiralty Island. No headstone or words recorded his demise, not even one candle lit in memory of his sacrifice. The courthouse was dark in the wind. A solitary lamp lit Deputy Staley's office. He was working late. No explanation for what happened next. The oil lamp on Staley's desk exploded. It did not tip or fall, but burst in a ball of flame. Spontaneous combustion. Fire with the wind soon took the whole building, even as help rushed up the hill. Prisoners were released. Volunteers raced to save documents and mining records. Most were saved. Many of the volumes and papers from this story were touched by that same fire, scorched at the edges. No fireproof vault, no electric lights, just a wooden courthouse built 5 years before, reduced to glowing coals and ashes. The fire was so hot, it melted the brass ball that sat atop the flagpole. The melted lump was picked up from the ruins that night, polished and sold as a gold nugget to some greenhorn waiting for a steamer down a tideline. In chaos, there is always opportunity. A roaring gale on a hilltop. No fire department could have stopped that pyre of flame. In the January night, the fire's radiance was seen 40 miles up Lynn Canal. It lit the snow-covered mountains of the wilderness with an eerie radiance seen by all. The Birch brothers? Well, they stuck with Alaska for a spell, even with Slim in jail. They got caught selling whiskey in a tent saloon at Sheep Camp, had a few mining claims up north. They even ran a roadhouse for a bit on Bonanza Creek. Did I mention the fourth brother, Sidney Birch, the youngest? When he shaved off that lip toupee, he had a pleasant demeanor. He met a delightful Irish Catholic girl who played a fine fiddle, and surprise, the Birch brothers were made for romance as well as trouble. Katie McMullen married Sidney, and by 1904 they had joined Robert and Slim in Prescott, Arizona. I was able to find Victoria Harris, the granddaughter of Sidney and Katie Birch, and she filled me in on the family history of Great Uncle Bob and Slim. As far as what happened in Juneau and Slim going to San Quentin, they had no idea. The living relatives were thrilled to hear the whole story. You keep seeking justice in this tale, and it runs away. The Birch Brothers, they opened a very successful saloon on Whiskey Row in Prescott, Arizona. Things went well for a while, but as usual, the brothers' sense of timing was off. The Prohibition arrived, and Brother Bob got caught selling bootleg whiskey with illegal gambling out of the saloon. Young Sidney left his partnership with Slim and Bob. Seems he was caught with a 300-gallon copper still in the family garage. Brothers Joseph and Slim proved far more dangerous and radical than anyone imagined. Later evidence showed that in 1894, before their arrival in Douglas, Alaska, Kid and Slim were in Cripple Creek, Colorado, in the violent miners' strike. They were identified with a group called the Bull Hill Dynamiters, fingered as leaders of a group that put a mining superintendent down the strong mine shaft, followed by 200 pounds of lit dynamite. Apparently, the group was part of the Western Federation of Miners, well armed with Winchester rifles. They practiced regularly and were crack shots. These rifle skills were needed when the mine owners hired a 1,200-man militia of deputies to go against the Union men. The mine owners armed these deputies to the teeth. Hired from the prisons and saloons of Denver, these were the meanest-looking deputies one could go to war with. One begins to understand the brothers' dislike for authority figures. Slim, still pouring drinks behind a bar, was the true radical. He worked with a waiter the saloon hired named Frank Little. If you know who the Union leader Joe Hill was, then look up Frank Little. In 1905, Slim and Little started a Prescott chapter of the Industrial Workers of the World with Frank as president and Slim as treasurer of the Wobblies. That wasn't enough. Slim's grandniece Vicki Harris told me one night Slim decided all wealth should be shared, so he climbed up on a rooftop in Prescott and threw his worldly savings into the street below, sharing it with everyone. No word on whether or not alcohol was involved in that decision. Brother Bob's angry response was, "Great, now we all have to support Slim for the rest of his life." Bob, always the talker, was the one who wore many hats. Busted for booze and gambling, he appealed up to the state Supreme Court and was acquitted. In 1931, at the height of the Great Depression, Bob Birch took his daughter down to the Agua Caliente racetrack in Tijuana, Mexico, and bought 5 tickets, betting on a fast horse named Mike Hall. Imagine their surprise when luck placed $50,000 in their pockets. That's over $769,000 in today's money. Must have always wanted to see his name on a billboard somewhere. Brother Bob became the owner and manager of a hot springs resort, 12 miles from Sentinel, Arizona. Seemed like a dream come true until the highway bypassed them, and then the hot springs dried up. Slim was the last of the Birch Brothers to leave this world. 23 days before his death, on June 27, 1952, he checked into the Arizona Pioneers home in Prescott. At the tender age of 91, Slim had outlived all his brothers, the first to come and the last to leave. As for Kid Birch, he stayed in Alaska, usually in Douglas, but often at Hoonah Hot Springs, also known as Robber's Roost, or today, Tenneke. 36 miles from where Deputy Watts died in the mountains of Admiralty, Kid Birch was hunting with friends on the 5th of December, 1902. Not much light that time of year. His hunting partner, William Thomas, had a serious case of buck fever. He drew down on what seemed a prime venison target downhill from where he stood and proceeded to put a bullet right through Kid Birch's heart. Dropped him dead, staining the snow and soil of the north with birch blood. There is a written record of the men in the hunting party expressing their remorse over the accident. And the body was brought to Juneau and shipped all the way to Hamilton, North Dakota, today with a population of 61. He was the only one not buried in the family vault in Prescott. The inscription on the tombstone reads, "We will meet in heaven." Or not. As for Deputy William C. Watts, he remains the first to fall and the last remembered. In Washington, D.C., his name is listed among the more than 200 U.S. Marshals who have fallen in the line of duty. His name was added in 1998 when a newspaper article was brought to their attention. Here in Juneau, not a word. When I think of Watts leaving home at 14 to be a cowboy who died alone with that star on his chest, well, I figure that golden North Star on our flag was put there by people like him, those who give all they have for the great land. This is your history, people. Don't let it fade away.
You've been listening to The Birch Brothers, a final western of The Last Frontier, written and read by Mark Whitman and made possible thanks to the Alaska State Museum Library and Archives, produced in the studios of KTOO-FM in Juneau.